This week on Retronauts, it's words about words. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish, and this is episode 579. I can't believe we've gone 578 episodes without talking about ourselves, basically, and about our work. I mean, we talk about it some, but it's never before been like it's going to be now. This episode is all about the stuff that we do, specifically the writing that we do, specifically the writing in print that we do. Because all of us here on this roundtable have written and published books. We are now famous authors. And this is a chance for us to tell you to go buy our work. No, actually, it's not. I don't feel good about just naked self-promotion. No one wants to listen to that. So here's the trade-off for this episode. We're going to talk about the books that we've published, and you're going to hear about that and hear all about where you can buy those books and support our existences. But in return for that, we're going to talk about the process of publishing and about just what it takes to create a book, to publish a book, to get something like that together. And the goal here is not just for us to talk about the work we've done, but hopefully to help inspire or inform people who are interested in creating their own books, their own publications about gaming or, you know, really whatever, to go out and get published, because it's easier to publish these days than it's ever been before in human history.
Yeah, for sure.
We've made come a long way since the Gutenberg press, and there is self-publishing. There are small press houses, you know, boutique houses. There are larger print companies that still give people contracts and things like that. There are a lot of options out there, and there's no one right way to create a book and no one right way to get published. There are probably wrong ways, but we're not going to talk about those. We're going to talk about just our different experiences and how we've gotten there. And just as an act of disclosure up front, I'm going to remind everyone that my day job is working at Limited Run Games as the head of Press Run Books, a book imprint under the video games company. But this is not an exercise in supporting that. Some of these books that we're going to talk about have been printed by Press Run, but not all of them. And this is not about, you know, me tooting my own horn. It's not about saying, hey, go buy our stuff. Go support my company. It is really just about us talking about our work and providing some transparency into how easy or difficult it's been for us to create these things and what it's taken to bring them to fruition and get them out into everyone's hands, hopefully. So without further ado, I'm going to let everyone else chime in and introduce themselves, starting with, of course, the most venerable of co-hosts here, who has been on the show the longest besides me.
Hey, everybody, it's Bob Mackey, and I am no longer illiterate.
Congratulations on that. I'm glad that you have chosen to read to succeed.
And Jeremy, I hate to contradict your entire intro, but I am here for naked self-promotion. I have a mortgage now, and I command everyone to buy my book.
Oh, you have a Vancouver mortgage, no less.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm about to take on a new 2023-sized mortgage, and it's not pretty, but I'm still, you know, going to offer the people a trade-off here, you know, a tit for a tat. So, yeah, that's fine. Your naked avarice can be balanced out by our generosity. I think that's the Retronauts promise to everyone.
Yes, I will still dance for nickels, but I do ask you to buy the book at the end of this podcast.
Fair enough. All right. Who was that who just chuckled?
Probably me, Nadia Oxford. I good word good real. Actually, probably some of the first stuff I published was for your zine, Parrish. One of the things I distinctly remember publishing is a breakdown of the book Chrysalids, because I thought it was related to the game Crystallis when I first heard, like, you know, kind of saw the two in successions. But they have nothing to do with each other, but they do involve, like, future kids in the future.
I don't remember that. I mean, I remember the zine, but I don't remember that article. But, you know, that was 20-something years ago, so I think I can be forgiven for forgetting the some of the fine-tuned particulars.
Yeah, I'm just cursed, that's all.
But you were writing before that, not in print, but online. Wrote some timeless works of fiction, I believe.
Oh, God, don't call them that.
All right. Let's move on down the East Coast to the person located midway between myself and Nadia. And that would be?
That would be me, Kevin Bunch. I had something clever and it just slipped my mind. Sorry, everybody.
That's okay. We love you.
That's okay. As long as you remember it, you know, for the second round of revisions. That's the great thing about print, about books, is that they a proper book does go through a few rounds of revisions. So you do have time to remember, oh, that thing, I need to include it.
God bless the editors.
I don't, you know, the books that I publish these days are based on the video series that I create. And by based on, I mean, I take the video scripts and I adapt them into something that works better in print, which involves a bit of rewriting and expansion. But I treat the videos as basically the first draft and then crowdsource, you know, corrections and editing. So when I screw up, people on YouTube are very happy to tell me, you screwed up. So I catch a lot of errors that way, and my books are much better for it. So that's, you know, part of the editorial process. So we'll, like I said, we'll get you in the edit rounds, Kevin. And then finally, bringing up the caboose here, from far, bringing up the caboose on the book train.
Oh, thank God. Okay. Hello, I'm Stuart Gipp. I read a book called All Games Are Good, and I'm just learning now that I can revise that to my intended title, which is All Games Are Bad.
Yes.
Because, of course, they are all
yes,
bad.
But that'll have to be in the second printing.
Yes.
It'll be great because people will think it's a new book.
Yeah,
but the text will be exactly
the same. It's a total scam. As long as I don't listen to this, of course.
Right, right. That's the trick. Cultivate two entirely distinct audiences. So just to begin with, a little bit of background here. You know, I was talking earlier about how publishing has been democratized, and it really has. When I was in college many thousands of years ago, I really wanted to go into print publishing and design. By the time I got out of college, everyone said, oh no, print is dead. Go onto the internet instead. So I ended up on the internet. And that was fine. And, you know, I was very fortunate to be able to be hired at 1UP.com back right before it launched and started there doing design. But eventually, I think everyone said, actually, you're probably, yeah, that's not so good. Why don't you go do writing instead? So I switched to writing and editing, and everyone seemed much happier that way. But, you know, I got there because of other people's generosity, other people taking a chance on me. And throughout my time there, I was able to publish in the Ziff Davis magazines, thanks to other people's generosity and taking a chance on me. And, you know, I've been very fortunate, and I was very sad when the print magazines went away. And at that point, my wife said to me, you know, you really like creating things in print. Why don't you self-publish? And she pointed me to a website called blurb.com, which was designed for publishing photo books for photographers.
Oh, I remember
and
that.
I said, oh, okay, I can make books here because I just upload files and they'll print them, which actually wasn't a great idea because being geared toward full color, you know, large format publications about photos, their books were very expensive. And so, you know, I was publishing these tiny little black and white publications that were mostly text.
Yes.
And they were extremely expensive. And yet I and the people who contributed to them made very, very little money because the actual net profit on those expensive books was minuscule. So, you know, there are many more printing options now, and they are varying degrees of generous with their royalty structure and with their pricing. But it's also easier to create small runs of books, pre-print them, you know, and get the volume discounts that way. When you're printing one book at a time, as with print on demand, it's just necessarily expensive. Mm-hmm. And printing, you know, a small press run of 1,000 books even cuts the price dramatically. And also you can afford to invest in better materials, better printing quality, you know, like web press or something versus just the digital process that they use for those print on demand photo books. So yeah, that's kind of where I started from this. And I've, you know, kind of spent the past 10, 12, 15 years ish making books just because it's a thing I enjoy doing. There's something very satisfying about seeing that layout, about getting the final product in your hands and saying, whoa, I did this. And then immediately it's on to the next thing because this is a restless world and there's no time to relax and enjoy things. But I don't want to talk too much about my stuff. Maybe I'll save that for the end if there's time. But I'm actually more interested in hearing what everyone else has to say about their processes and about the books that they've created. Because you're not me, and so I don't know your stories. Some I know better than others. Like Kevin, I helped you and Stuart get your books to, you know, over the finish line into print. But even so, like, I don't necessarily know about how you went about sourcing your material and finding your inspiration and just, you know, what kind of writing do you do? Like, how do you do your writing, et cetera, et cetera. So I'd like to talk about that. So I will. Actually, I think, Bob, your book is the most recently published, so why don't we start with you? First sure. of all, what did you create? What is this book that you have produced?
I created a book that is a very in-depth oral history on the LucasArts point-and-click adventure game Day of the Tentacle. Like, I basically wanted to talk to everybody who was involved with the game and learn more about it, because this is, I mean, people, there's a lot of retrospectives on like Monkey Island and Sam & Max and other LucasArts games, but I found that this game, while a beloved adventure game that people really like, there wasn't a lot of research or scholarship or interviews on the subject, so I wanted to make the definitive exploration of the game, and that's exactly what I set out to do with this project.
So this is published through Boss Fight Books, correct?
That's right.
So what's the process there? Did they contact you? Did you contact them? Did they have just like a big pile of book projects that they wanted someone to write about and you said, I'll do that one?
Well, I think this is a very long time. By the way, this book took about 6 years from the pitch to release. So my mm-hmm. I think my story is going to be much different than everyone else's. Because like COVID happened in the middle of me writing my book, and that delayed things on both ends a lot. But yeah, they had a call for pitches. I believe they do this pretty regularly, Boss Fight Books. And if you want to pitch to them, you can. And it was December of 2017, and I pitched a book. Actually, I pitched a Maniac Mansion book initially, and then it changed to the Day of the Tentacle book because I realized that I had already done a lot of the groundwork because I had written tens of thousands of words on the game for US Gamer for a very in-depth cover story. And I felt like a book project would be the great good way to sit down and refine that with the time I didn't have as someone who was writing for a website and also doing two podcasts on top of that in 2016.
So I actually don't remember that cover story. Was that when I was EIC or was that later?
Yes, it was when you were EIC. It wow, published that's... when the Day of the Tentacle Remastered released in...
Don't I feel like an asshole?
No. Hey, you approved it. But yeah, it released when the Day of the Tentacle Remastered version came out in like spring of 2016. And it was written to go along with that remaster. So it was for US Gamer. And I was proud of what I had done at the time, but I was running up against like realistic constraints and deadlines for a website. And like I said, also having to do other things for a website and also having to work on two podcasts. So I felt like I could do more with it. I felt like it could be expanded upon. And it was essentially all I wanted to do in the press. This is kind of like my capstone project for the press, basically, where mm-hmm. I've kind of met everybody I wanted to meet within reason. Some people that are unmeetable, I took them off my list. And this was kind of the last thing I wanted to do. And I did it, but I felt like, oh, if I could go back and revisit this, I'd really love to put like some more polish on it. And then in the process of, you know, working on the revised version, which took years and years and many edits, and writing a lot of new content, US Gamer went away. So I was like, oh, there's an even better reason for me to write this, because, you know, millions of my words that I wrote, you can't read anymore. But now this is available in a physical form. Ziff Davis can't buy all the copies and burn them.
They can try.
I will say, in fairness, US Gamer went away, but you can still read your words if you go to VG247 and wade through a bunch of pop-ups.
That's true, yes. I mean, so, like, a lot of the US Gamer content has been retained. I'm not sure how much of it.
I could probably step in and kind of tell you what happened. VG247, it was really good of them. They archived everything. There's also someone who, I'm really sorry, I can't remember their name, but they archived pretty much all of US Gamer on archive.org. But VG247 has our features, but our news stories, I think, are all gone, which is unfortunate, because that means, so our headlines, I wrote like Animal Crossing has Tarantula Island because God is dead or something like that. Like, I wrote some funny headlines there. But they did spare a lot of our work, which I'm glad for.
I mean, just like in general, the you know, writing on the internet for the past 22 years of my life, means that 99% of my work is not available, and that's like millions of words. And it's nice to have something that a company can't take away and delete. Because I was actually writing my author blurb for the book, and I was like, Bob Mackey is a writer who lives in Vancouver. He has worked on these websites. And as I was writing them all down, I realized, like, oh, none of these exist anymore. They're people dead. Are going to think I'm making this up. It's why I can't ever apply for a real job. If I list what I've worked on, if people look this up, they're going to be like, you just made up Dorkly. That's not a real word.
Oh, my God.
What's the mayor of Candyland. Okay, sure, buddy.
Yeah.
61 frames per second. What the hell is that?
Exactly. Well, yeah, exactly. Like, I realized, like, oh, my God, everything I worked on is gone now. So then as I'm working on the book, I'm realizing more and more why it needs to exist, because, like, everything is disappearing. And then I sit down to write my blurb, and it's just like, well, everything I've done is gone. So it's important that at least some physical object, something will be around after I'm gone to prove that I did anything for 20 years of my life writing in the press.
Yeah. The it's kind of inevitable that US Gamer stuff went over to VG247, because that last year, 2016, that I was EIC, management became very, I would say, hostile to deep dive feature content, and said, what you need to do is stuff that's more like VG247, just, you know, like post 20 news articles an hour and make them as clickbaity as possible. That's what games journalism needs to be. And that is why I stopped being there, because I can't do that. My brain's not geared that way. No judgment on people whose minds are geared that way. Mine just can't do that. And I saw that the writing was on the wall, and I needed to go away. Mm. But, that really does get to one of the fundamental values. One of the fundamental appeals of print is that once something is printed, unless, you know, someone really goes for it and tries to track down every copy of it and set fire to it, it's there. You can own it. You like, no one can take that away. If you can get that into libraries or bookstores, then it, you know, just proliferates and spreads. And, people will occasionally ping me and say, hey, I saw one of your GameSpite zines in, you know, a half price books or something. And, you know, those were self-published, self-distributed 15 years ago. And people are still finding them at random bookstores far, far away from anywhere I've ever lived. And that's cool. Like, you know, my words and the words of everyone I collected in through those volumes is still out there. And even though we made very, very little money off of those things, the writing and the thoughts still exist. And actually, the GameSpite Quarterly, the GameSpite Zine, is what got me my job at Limited Run Games, because the CEO of the company, Josh Fairhurst, bought all of those publications that I was putting out because he was like, wow, cool. Someone's writing stuff about video games in an interesting way. That's really great. And so, you know, when the opportunity came to have me do that kind of thing for his company as a full-time project, he was like, yeah, come do it. So, you know, once we did some initial books that succeeded, like my Super NES Works and Virtual Boy Works books, they did way better than anyone anticipated. And he said, we need to have a book imprint. That would be a great thing to add to our video game company because it's, you know, it's something different. It expands what we're doing in terms of business. And, you know, I think it's kind of seen as something that adds some legitimacy to a company that sometimes kind of gets a bad rap for things that are out of our control. So, yeah, it's kind of nice to have that, that extra bit of like, no, we're actually doing cool stuff in print. You may not like what we're doing in terms of video games. They may not be to your taste or, you know, you don't like our distribution processes, but come on, you can't not like books. Books are good. They're, you know, they predate video games by centuries.
Everybody likes books.
Exactly.
Yeah. But like, I mean, the reality of what's happened to the internet and websites over the past 10 to 15 years is why I'm much happier having been a full-time podcaster for the past 7 years. It's also why I'm very happy to write this book and one, to have written this book. And one thing that I feel that, I didn't really have the chance to, take advantage of when I was in the press was an editor because all of the teams I was on, they were very, very small and nobody had time to look over anyone else's work. It's like, if you're not working on something to publish, then you're wasting time. We need to stay afloat. So very few times I've had an editor, and sometimes the editors were bad, the few times I've had them. And I really value a good editor because a good editor will improve your work or they will like, they'll show you something you haven't even noticed about your own writing. Bad editors will be like, write this like I would write it or tell you something insane, like every sentence must have an opinion. Which I've encountered editors like that. I'm like, what is this? This feels like a puzzle or something. But yeah, my editors at Boss Fight Books were great. And they really helped elevate the material and show me like issues with my own writing that I've now incorporated into writing the little writing I do today. But I feel that it's unfortunate, but we just could never take advantage of copy editors. And you hear like in the past, like somebody's job at a website would be copy editor. And that just sounded insane to me as someone who just could never stop writing out of necessity for a website.
It's funny because no one who worked on games websites had a title of writer. It was always something editor. And yet editing was the one thing we never got to do. Yeah, I really missed, you know, when 1UP was under the Ziff Davis Publications banner, we had great copy editors like Jason Wilson who were so thoughtful and would add so much to your work and really, you know, take the time to, I think, bring out the best of your ideas. And I learned a lot from Jason.
Yeah,
I tried to pass along to, you know, the works that I edit under Press Run. But yeah, like when they started cutting heads, that was the first department to go. They were like, oh, making our work better. Who gives a crap about that? Get rid of
those guys.
That
just slows us down.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the slower, more deliberate process of publishing books is great. Were there any particular challenges you had to, you know, kind of deal with working on your Day of the Tentacle book besides, you know, COVID?
Well, COVID, actually the funny and big scare quotes thing is I remember turning in my big first draft on like the eve of COVID, on COVID eve, basically. It was like March 18th, 2020. The coffee shop. Yeah, I think that could be the exact date. And like the coffee shop I had usually been working in, they were closing early because of COVID. And there was like this really eerie thing where we didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know what was going to happen. And I thought like, oh, I'll just get another cup of coffee. And there was just no employees in the coffee shop. I didn't know where they went.
Oh, that's terrifying.
I should just leave. And yeah, that's when I turned in my first draft. But yeah, COVID really slowed things down in terms of it slowed down Boss Fight Books. They had regular releases before COVID, and then during COVID they really slowed down the releases for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. But I think some of the big challenges were writing a very extensive intro for the book that grounded my oral history in the context of what are adventure games? What is the history of adventure games? Why is this one important? That is something that I didn't have to consider with my oral history because, you know, if you are on a website and you're looking for things about a game you like, you don't need that context. But here, it required a lot more for this project, and it was a real balance of how do I explain this and keep it interesting and keep it in my own voice and not make it so I'm talking down to people, because all of this history is in my head. And I assume that most people know it, but then when I put it on the page, it's like, oh, this is actually way more complicated than I realized.
Yeah, the books that I've been putting together based on the videos that I mentioned, there's a lot of context that I add to the videos that is visual, you know, like footage of games that I'm referencing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's the entire continuity of videos and all of YouTube, basically, for people to look at if they want to learn more. And that doesn't exist within the book. So, yeah, that is definitely a challenge. I do a lot of additional writing. I would say probably the bulk of the additional material I put into each book is just sidebars for added context. I don't want to make, you know, overstuff any of the individual articles about games because they're already pretty dense. So then I have to kind of say, well, what here is not actually going to make sense to someone who's just picking this book up off the shelf and reading about the history of, you know, NES games in 1987. So there's a lot of thought that goes into that. But, you know, I think that's a good problem to have. It just means you kind of have to be mindful of the audience that you're writing for. And again, that's what editors are good for, because they will come in and say, hey, you know, you're kind of living in your own head here, but think about the reader.
Yeah, that really did help getting people who weren't as knowledgeable about adventure games to look at the book. Terms, I can't think of any offhand, but, you know, certain terminology they would question, like, well, what does this mean? You have to explain
like
this.
Like parser?
Yeah, things like that. And even like video game press words that we relied on in the past that were still in my work. Like, well, what is this? What does this mean? Things like that. I guess another challenge was also having to work with some of the creative people who were on the game. I mean, the interviews were done in 2016, and I used my power of the press to get them done. But then the unfortunate thing about working for a website is once you are laid off or leave, you lose all of your emails or all of your contacts. So I'm going to tell all of you folks out there, I would say try to move a lot of conversations to private email when you talk to famous people, and then
yeah,
you'll still have
sure.
all their contact information. That's just my little tip for all of you out there. So I had to get in touch with Tim Schafer again, which was easy to do because I think it was like at PAX 2019, I was helping my wife, Nina Matsumoto, run the Fangamer booth. And I think Double Fine's booth was just across from them. So I was able to talk to him and get him to write the afterword. It was going to be the foreword. And Tim Schafer almost broke my heart because...
Aww.
He agreed to do it, and then there was like a lot of back and forth, and then he just like totally ghosted me, and that's because he was working on Psychonauts 2. He didn't need to email me. I totally understand why. And then when the Kickstarter for the books was announced, he realized that he owed me the piece of writing for the book, and he got back to me immediately. So I'm glad that I didn't have any you know, sore feelings about Tim Schafer after the production of this book, but I totally understand if he couldn't have done it. But things like that, working with creative people, having to tell creative people, oh, our editor wants you to actually change what you wrote, a person who worked on the game I'm talking about. So that was something I wasn't really anticipating.
So with the book out in, you know, printed in the world, in hands, is there anything about it that you look at and you're like, ah, that could have been better? Or do you feel like it is kind of the work you envisioned and you're ready to move on to the next project?
I really wish I had time for follow-up interviews, interviewing. I only interviewed one of the three composers who worked on the game, and I wish I had time to track them down and talk to them. That just couldn't happen, and maybe if there's a second edition of this book, I could try to include that material. But yeah, that's really, I feel like, the only shortcomings of the book. But I feel like, as it stands, it is the most comprehensive piece of work on this game. And even in its old format, the three feature articles are cited constantly on the Wikipedia page of Day of the Tentacle. And I'm glad that my citations live on in more Wikipedia pages than just bad Simpsons games. We'll be right back.
All right, so let's move along to Nadia. You know, one of the things that I really like about this group that is connected here is that everyone really kind of took a different approach to the work that they did. Like, Stuart is very much kind of like, you know, opinion column, whereas Kevin is very much a sort of academic approach, very research-oriented. Bob, yours was a very journalistic approach with lots of interviews and just kind of pulling together that oral history into, you know, something that takes a lot of random and distinct conversations and turns them into a single narrative. And Nadia, I would say you, your work is somewhere between like database writer and fan fiction writer, which I think is kind of sums up your mindset as a whole, honestly. Yeah. But could you tell us about the books you have published? You were actually the first among us here to land a proper book deal and actually have someone else publish your work, as opposed to going to a website and saying, I'm going to make my own book. Gosh darn it.
I have been published in at least one of those. Like, I can't remember the name of the module right now, but someone wrote like a D&D based module where, I kind of helped out with the character bios and information and whatnot and, wrote some stories for them. But yeah, the book I suppose I'll be talking about most is the, Mega Man X Maverick Hunter's Field Guide, which is the one I worked on the most. I also worked on the Robot Master Field Guide. Both of them, I was kind of a co-writer beside my husband, David Oxford. We kind of worked on it together, which was fun. But Mega Man X was the one that's closer to my heart because I'm just a big Mega Man X fan. And whereas the Robot Master Field Guide was more academic and kind of based on the information you got about the Robot Masters, etc., from the CDs. And I think it was Mega Man and Base was the game that had the CD, CD yeah. logs.
Sounds right.
Yeah. So that was kind of a transcription of that with some, you know, stuff added in. But the Mega Man X Maverick Hunter Field Guide was a much more of a fan-based project where I got to write, like, the biographies for a lot of these Mavericks and characters. Like, the way it's supposed to be set up is that you pretend or you are a new Maverick Hunter on the job, let's just say, and for some reason or another, you can't get access to your database, so you have to use, like, a good old-fashioned analog manual, and that's what this is. And it kind of explains the characters, the weapons, the armor sets. My husband did, like, all the writing for the armor sets and whatnot. Like, that's really his kind of writing that he loves doing, but myself, I'm just like, I'm going to slip a Half-Life reference into the Dynamo profile, see if anyone notices. And nobody noticed, but I thought it was pretty funny when I did it. But yeah, that was – if you look at the Zero profile, that one has the most pages spent on it because, of course, it does. That's the one I wrote.
Well, also, Zero is kind of the biggest of those characters, you know, the most significant narratively.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's that? Ironic?
Yeah, Zero being the most prominent of all.
He's a zero and a hero. My
yeah,
God.
There you go. He has the long hair. That's how I know he's cool. It's the rule of cool in anime.
And that music that plays. Hell yeah.
Yeah, that's, I mean, he rushes in to save you. And so he is just like a captivating character from the start. And when you're a dumb teenager, not even a teenager at that point, like, oh, that's so cool. I love his character. So I kind of have this lifelong love affair with Zero. And yeah, as you say, Parrish, he is probably the most interesting character in the series. He links a lot of the games, especially Mega Man X, Mega Man Zero, and probably Mega Man ZX as well. So,
And the original series, thanks to the magic of retconning.
Right. Yeah, he's Wily's creation. Apparently that was always planned, according to Inafune. But,
sure.
Yeah, whatever sure, you say.
So Nadia, you said this was a fan creation, but your Mega Man books are official licensed products published through Udon Books, who have a long-running partnership with Capcom. Like, they've published Mega Man books, they've published, like, their monthly Street Fighter Girls and Bikinis calendars and, you know, all those things.
Yeah, I should reiterate that this is not really a fan project. Like, everything here is canon. It's been approved by Capcom several times over. It's all good. It's,
even the Half-Life reference?
Yes.
Amazing.
Well, I just said that Dynamo is a man who Dynamo proves that the wrong man in the wrong place can make all the difference in the world or something like that.
Oh, okay.
I just thought that
not
was
not like when he started working at Black Mesa.
No, I didn't say Dynamo is the G-Man.
He caused the Resonance Cascade.
That would be a really cool addition to Half-Life. But anyway, yeah, it's totally official. It's all approved. It's all canon. I made it as fun as possible still, and I'm sure David did as well. But yeah, this is it was published by Capcom. And they dealt with most of the layout. They dealt with, of course, a lot of the editing. Thankfully, there was not a lot of editing. Capcom is pretty – they're not exactly hands-off, but they're pretty like, you know, okay, cool, whatever. that sounds good to us. Like, I've also written for them with their, not just in print, but the album covers for Breath of Fire. I've written those covers. And Capcom's generally pretty good about saying, okay, yeah, that's cool, that's fun. Some companies will be like, oh, you can't mention this, you can't mention that. But Capcom, they have fun with their properties, and so do I.
Yeah, generally what I find with Japanese publishers, most of the time, the things that they will draw the line at is, first, if you are too effusive about their creations, they're like, that's too much. Tone it down.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Don't be too positive. That's not in keeping with, you know, the modesty that we want to project.
Yes, I've
learned
that.
They'll draw the line there. They draw the line at you mentioning anything that exists outside of their company. Like,
yes.
A thing they did not create, a property they did not create, even as a passing mention. Nope. If you want to talk about someone who created something while they were at the company and then left the company, nope.
Nope. Nope.
But then other than that, yeah, they're generally pretty hands off as long as you are kind of sensible and knowledgeable about what you're doing. You know, the biggest notes I've gotten back on my Konami liner notes for stuff like Bayou Billy, some of the people who actually composed those albums, those soundtracks are still with the company, and the liner notes apparently passed through their hands, and they're like, oh, actually, you know, here's an interesting thing that I did with like the sampling channel on the Famicom. Mm-hmm. And that's to me the most important thing about the soundtrack. So be sure to include that. But you know, that's not a big deal. That's like, oh, cool. Here's an insight from the creator. I'm more than happy to incorporate that. But yeah. In my experience, Japanese publishers tend to be actually a lot more chill about approving external submissions about their work than Western publishers are.
Yeah, and I think Capcom has also been working for a very long time with Udon, which is based in and around Toronto, actually. So cool.
So what was the process of becoming involved with that book? Like, how do you end up writing, you know, basically a database of Mega Man X Mavericks?
Well, me and David, we kind of know one of the editors at Udon, and we had talked for a long time about possibly doing Mega Man books. And eventually the Robot Master Field Guide came out, and that actually did quite well, especially in book fairs, apparently. Kids really like to pick it up there, which is really awesome, I think.
Yeah, it's colorful and it's lots of tiny chunks of text, so it's not too daunting. Yeah. Very kid-friendly, for sure.
So we kind of wanted to do a follow-up for Mega Man X, of course, and we started planning that. And one thing to say about Capcom, even though they are very cool and hands-off, they can take a long time with approvals. So we had to wait forever. And for a long time, we figured, okay, this isn't happening. We'll just kind of go on with our lives. And then out of nowhere, said editor reached out to David and I and said, hey, you know, do you want to do this Mega Man X field guide? And yeah, of course we do. So once we got that, the second half kind of running, like it went really smoothly. We had like help from a lot of great people, like Brian from Protodude from the Rockman Corner and Ash Paulson, of course, and Servebot20 on Twitter, who's been like a friend of mine since the 90s. And he's like the guy who knows everything about Japanese Rockman. So we name all the consultants and acknowledgments in the book. And yeah, we're glad to have them all. But it went quite well. I am not good at – one thing that kind of keeps me from publishing more is that I'm so bad at layouts. Like I'd love to just kind of self-publish Bob Mackie mentioned how much – like so much of my writing has gone into the shade. But I have quite a bit of it because I wrote on documents and stuff like that. So I'd love to just kind of – get that bundled and out there. And I'm talking to someone about that. But otherwise, I still have other books in the works, hopefully. Again, like Mackie, I've realized that going independent is really the only way to survive in this horrible workspace. So we actually went independent, actually Blood God, our podcast, after COVID got US Gamer shut down. And since then, Kat and I and Eric and Victor and Mike, like we've all been doing really well, thankfully, with the show. But I like to get my writing out there more. You know, I've kind of like gotten lazy about my writing. I'm working on a fiction book. I'm working on like kind of a game related book that you know about, Parrish, and hopefully get that somewhere. But yeah, I'm producing. I am producing.
Let's see. I feel like there was something else I was going to ask you, but now I can't remember what it was.
Oh no.
Is it about Duff McWhalen?
It might be.
We have the quote unquote proper name. in the Maverick Hunter Field Guide, but we have like nicknames or like also known as. So I can't even remember what – Tuttle Whale. That was the name of Duff McWhalen. So we have Tuttle Whale, also known as Duff McWhalen. And, you know, fun fact, the Japanese games each give each Maverick kind of a title that doesn't show up in English. So like Storm Eagle is like the Prince of the Skies, and Morph Moth, whatever his name was like Fallen Angel of the something or other. Stuff like that we included as well in the also known as. Just we took all the information we could possibly glean from all the sources that we had out there. Like, for example, did you know Wheel Alligator was declared Maverick after he left a tooth in a compatriot's leg or something? So that's the kind of stuff we included in the field guide. We just really had fun with it.
Love it.
It's great.
So was it difficult to track down all that info?
No.
Some of it seems pretty esoteric, but maybe it's pretty well documented online at this point.
David and I are both sickos. Like, we have a lot of stuff. God, I have like Iwamoto's mangas all kind of, you know, in a row on my shelf. Not that we used Iwamoto in the book, but I would have loved to. We have just all this information stored up. Again, Servbot 20 is like, if you go to the Reploid Research Laboratory, and yes, the misspelling is totally intentional.
It's also canon in the game, isn't it?
It's canon by localization, that's for sure. That's where all the Reploids go to take a piss, I guess. Oil everywhere. But yeah, Servbot 20 has been really good about documenting all this stuff from Japan. And Udon, of course, has access to stuff as well if we needed it. But they've put out a couple of source books from Maverick even before we started these projects. So that was handy as well.
So going really kind of to the other extreme from Nadia's official work on Mega Man, let's talk to Stuart, who your work is extremely not official, but
it is, yeah.
It is. It's also lots of kind of, you know, small bits of information that you can easily digest in whatever form you like. So tell us a little bit about your book and where that got started, how that got started.
My book's called All Games Are Good, and it's more of a philosophy than a factual sort of statement, because you would not believe how often I get that thrown at me on Twitter when I say I don't like something. I thought you said all games were good, Stu. You're the first person to say that to me.
You can dislike good things, that's fine.
But of course, my only response is to say, you're right, I concede. but what it is, I mean, the way it sort of came about was Jeremy asked me a few years ago if I would write some short things for the website, for the Retronauts website, about games that I don't know how it had developed, but I had this sort of I don't like to use the term reputation because it sounds self-aggrandizing, but I think you knew that I genuinely liked things that a lot of people don't tend to like or talk about or just sort of write off. And I've been writing about that stuff just sort of elsewhere, like on websites like Game Cola, which is like a kind of, it was sort of like, this is undermining the people who worked for it. I don't mean to do that because they did sort of work very hard, but it was like it started as like a Yahoo newsletter. You know, and then it sort of developed into a website where we would all write stuff, and there wasn't any sort of money involved. It was just kind of a passion thing, and it was fun. But then I'm not sure how exactly how it came about. There's kind of a question mark there. It's slightly a sort of underpants gnomes, like, you know, but because Jeremy got in touch, I think maybe from seeing my YouTube stuff, Stuart Jip in Video World, which is basically just me and passionately yelling about like Jim Power, the Lost Dimensions and stuff like that. And I sort of came in and I was just doing like these kind of 500 word things about like Spyro, Attack of the Rhinox, or like Cosmic Spacehead and Alfred Chicken and all those kind of things that I genuinely loved, because I had this kind of incorrect gaming sort of upbringing of just not having Nintendo and just playing whatever I could sort of get my hands on for Micros or for Master System. It's all the wrong stuff that you really are not supposed to enjoy. And putting it that way, it makes it sound like I'm trying to be like a contrarian, but it's not. It's like I try to be as intellectually honest as I can, even when that honesty is me saying, like, I think this thing is really obviously about 6 out of 10, but I love it anyway. What eventually happened is I ended up getting like hundreds of these short pieces of writing, almost all of which were kind of positive slants on something that was sort of lesser known, or maybe like a European game, or like some American platformer that tanked, or it's just something confusing that only I enjoy, or even something that sucks that I really like Action Patchio, the kind of the egg rolling game on the Super Nintendo. It's like it's like cross between Dizzy and Sonic, and nobody talks about it for good reason.
Wait, that's a Patchio game, like Patchio-kun, the pachinko ball.
I think so. I don't know who that is. I've
made videos about Pachio-kun.
Oh, wow. Well, there we go. Crossover.
The pachinko ball that plays pachinko. It's kind of weird.
Yeah.
Like his people are enslaved in these pachinko machines, and he's just out there tossing coins in there.
It's a little
messed up.
It is kind of, when you think about it. I didn't really approach that angle. Maybe I need to come back and reissue. But so what it ended up being like was I wanted to compile those pieces of writing for reasons that has already been mentioned, that I knew that a blog, a website, is kind of ephemeral, and I don't mean to be arrogant, but I wanted to preserve this writing because I thought some of it was pretty good and funny. Because I was kind of coming at it like, initially I was a little bit tentative because I wanted to retain the work, you know? I didn't want to come out full jip and just like alienate everyone immediately.
No, I mean, I think there is something inherently arrogant about wanting to publish a book and preserve it, you know, like, here's my work, it must be, you know, made into a physical form and enshrined forever. And that's okay. You need that sense of pride and, you know, kind of determination to make stuff like this happen. If people didn't have that element, then we wouldn't have books, and how boring would that be?
It's true. It would be a terrible world without books, especially. But so, yeah, I compiled all this stuff myself. It wasn't edited at all. It was just how it was, with some minor changes that I'd made. And I had mentioned it in passing, I think, to Jeremy. Like, I think I'd said, would it be okay with you if I did, like, self-publish this or republish this? Because originally it was written for the Retronauts. And the sort of response was more like, well, you know, I'm doing this press run thingamajig. And I was like, I'm listening. And then there was sort of a fairly long process after that, which I guess we could put down to COVID again, but also it was then edited. And what needed to be done was to sort of bring it all to some kind of coherent state, because like I mentioned, when I first started doing it, I was a little bit tentative, and I was going down this kind of sliding scale of like, I wonder how silly I can get away with being like when I write this, because there's something that was in British games journalism, and I hesitate to even call it games journalism, but British games magazines coverage, which was that they would be as silly and esoteric as possible, and as out there as possible, and sometimes barely mention the games whatsoever, just write absolute nonsense and then put a score on the end. And I absolutely loved that, and I wanted to read it, but I also wanted to kind of marry that with, you know, intellectual honesty and actual opinion that's sort of worth reading and well thought out, hopefully, you know. So I wanted to create something that was as entertaining to me as that stuff, but also had some kind of value to people who weren't already completely tuned into it. Like, you could pick it up and you could be like, okay, this is kind of funny, but also that's interesting. <You know? laughs> Rather than just being like, why is he writing all this stuff about this guy's arm? That makes no sense. I don't understand. Because I used to get comments like that, just like, what? I wrote about that, the Pitfall game on the GameCube, and the only thing I wrote about is that on the right stick you can wobble his arm around, and I thought that was funny. And I would get comments like, "Why? What is he talking about? Why is he talking about his arm? This is ridiculous. Stop." So just kind of marry that kind of irreverence with some rather good and hopefully sort of emotional sort of content. It is a sort of a grab bag. It's the sort of thing that I enjoy reading, which is just like every time you turn the page, you're going to be seeing, like, almost every time you turn the page, it's going to be, like, a new game. And there's something like, what, 400-odd pages in this book? I don't even know the page count of my own book. I'm pretty sure it's 400 odd. It's a chunk.
420 something, I think.
Yeah. 420
blaze
or something.
Blaze it.
drugs, am I right? I wanted it to be this huge, this tome you could pick up and open and sort of be entertained and hopefully informed, you know, and maybe you'd come away from it and go like, some of the enthusiasm would rub off and you go, oh, I kind of want to give this game a try now. I want to try out Tinhead, or I want to try out, like, I don't know, Stone Protectors. I'm not sure either of those games are in the book, save them for the
Stone
sequel.
Stone Protector.
Yeah, exactly. That's coming out on Steam soon, or like, it's weird.
Dang.
Yeah, I know. But yeah, those will be in the sequel. Not all games are good, but it came together as this kind of sort of relatively long process of editing that was still kind of painless because it was never taking sort of the personality out of it. It was always sensible things like, Stu, there are 100 semicolons on this page. I feel like, so there are. I found out about semicolons and I was just like, yes. And proceeded to use them all the time.
That's part of your personality now, the semicolon.
Yeah, the semicolon, yeah, yeah. I thought of a really gross joke about that. I'm going to leave it.
Yeah, I find as an editor, the majority of my suggestions and edits are just, please don't make every sentence passive. Please do not make every sentence, there is this, this was that. Like,
yeah, you sort of trained me out of that and made me.
Well, I will let you know that you are not alone in that. That's something
I'm struggling with passive. That's something I'm working on.
That's something that editors passed to me back in the days when websites were edited. And I took it to heart, and it made me painfully aware of the fact that, wow, everyone, not everyone, but lots of people just kind of default to writing like this. And, you know, it's fine to have some of that. But every sentence is structured like that, everything develops this kind of tiring, exhausting rhythm. And it just stops being fun to read. I'm not saying that your book was like that, just that, you know, that is a danger that, I don't think many people are aware of. And
I think it's fair to say, because at the point of editing, that's what editing was for, was for removing that. And I was going through a fair amount of it and changing that sort of, that tone to make it more readable, to make it more exciting to read and sort of more punchy. I was also adding in, sort of lots of new stuff, taking out the bits that were either too profane or didn't make any sense. I mean, there is still some really sort of far out stuff in there. There's like a sort of transcript of a marriage ceremony between me and a copy of Sonic 3 and Knuckles, which I thought was
that's
quite
one
fun.
Of the highlights of the book. So it's
I was really proud of that. I was prepared sort of to say like, no, this is staying in. It's too funny. But
I don't think there was any question. Really, yeah, I don't think there's any question of us taking that out.
Okay,
was like,
good.
No.
I'm glad.
No, I mean, this is an important landmark moment in Stuart's life. We have to leave this. It explains why he is the man that he is.
I have a question for both of you in this book. I haven't had a chance to page through it, but did Jeremy have to edit out the superfluous British U's in the book, or are they kept in?
Oh, that's a good question.
I'm living in Canada now, so I'm getting used to color and flavor having a U's jammed in there. But
yeah, welcome to Canada, bitch.
I'm pretty sure it was all kept British spelling, wasn't it? It was all
kept it was.
British.
There, you used too many British idioms for us to take out some of the British spellings to make it more American. And I feel like, you know, this being it being a personal memoir, really, and very much about your own experiences and tastes, it would have rung false to take out like your culture and your nationality. So
it's
we left that for sure.
No hitting Control F and looking for the word bin.
The word bin is so funny, though.
Like, I love the word bin, Stuart.
It's so good. I mean, I do like garbage fire. That's fun, too. But, like, just big burning bin is funnier to me.
Burning bin is pretty good. I'm just Canadian spelling.
There's Big Ben, and then there's Big Burning Bin. Not to be mistaken for one another.
But it was nice to sort of have this thing that sort of came together, I think, as what I was really aiming for was just something very entertaining. I think it is quite entertaining, but I also tried, when it came to book form, to give it some context, like at the beginning of each chapter, it's just like, here is my personal relationship with this system. And some of it's just sort of this esoteric sort of personal stories about how I sort of came across this. And some of them I think were reasonably emotional. And what it creates is this sort of portrait, like, oh god, I sound like a wanker when I said that.
Keep going.
It creates this portrait of, I think it says on the back, like, someone who played all the wrong games, but it's how my taste developed in such, in a sort of organic way to appreciate stuff that just does not get a look in. And it's not that there's anything wrong with anyone taking any approach to whatever, you know, to whatever they enjoyed, but I thought it would be nice to have something kind of different out there that wasn't just kind of like the history of gaming is nothing, then Super Mario Brothers, Atari, then nothing, then Super Mario Brothers at the end. I wanted to get all the silly stuff like Ollie and Lisa that I played on the Spectrum in there, and the Father Christmas, the official game, is in there. You know, that's a classic. That's a banger of a game. Yeah. I'm so bad at talking about my own book, it's embarrassing. Read the words in it instead. That's what I recommend.
So given that this book was not, you know, an act of research-based journalism or anything, it was very much about personal experiences.
Yeah.
Did you find that there were any parts of it that were particularly difficult for you to see through, or was it all a fairly, you know, fluid, easygoing experience?
Well, I feel like a small amount of imposter syndrome, because there was, to a degree, a lot of it was already written, and it was kind of like almost serendipitous that I mentioned it and then you said, oh, let's have a look at that, and that sort of came together quite quickly, and it's like, oh, okay, cool, you know. But sort of revisiting it, really the main challenge for me was really, how can I make this something more to take away than just here's what I think about some video games. I feel like that was achieved. I think it somehow came together quite nicely. I'm very pleased with, like, the way, and this has nothing to do with me, but the way it's laid out and the way it's been presented, it gives it the perfect level of, like, gravitas, which is, like, as I think you've described it, airport, like, Stephen King or Michael Crichton novel, like, level of quality, you know?
Yeah, I don't think I've mentioned this on the show before.
Oh, you haven't? Okay.
But... Oh, maybe I have. I don't think so. But if I'm repeating myself, I apologize. But yeah, my process when putting together the materials for this book, like picking the paper, was not to find, you know, like a smooth, kind of glossy style of paper, but to really try to recapture the sense of, you know, like an airport paperback, or what you'd pick up at the gas station on a long vacation or whatever. Like, I wanted to evoke, and maybe it's a childhood memory that doesn't convey to younger generations, but when I was, you know, a teenager, and my family would go on long car trips, and I was, you know, like 12 years old or whatever, I didn't have a Game Boy, so I took books with me and would read in the car until the sun went down and I couldn't read anymore. And they were always these like giant, chunky Dean Koontz or Stephen King books, just enormous. Yeah. And this book is already lengthy, you know, at 400 odd pages.
Yeah.
But I wanted to make it even more substantial. So I picked out a paper that's very toothy and textured.
Nice.
So if you look at the, your book compared to my Sig Eiden book, SG-1000 Works, which has basically the same page count. It's like within 10 pages of each other. Mm. Your book is much, much thicker, because I went with just like a very smooth, slick, glossy paper for my book, because it's, you know, really focused around photography and images, screenshots and things like that. And those need to be vibrant and pop. And your book, on the other hand, because it's almost entirely text and just a handful of screenshots and some black and white illustrations, it could afford to be on a different kind of paper. So it's very textured and it's very thick as a result. But to me, that just lends it a sense of authenticity. Like, this is, you know, the kind of book I would have seen at Walden Books in, you know, 1989 and said, ooh, I need to take this with me. It's about video games and I love those. And it's going to take me a long time to read through this. So this is my summer reading.
As you say, it works for sort of the sort of general personal nature of it. If it was glossy, it would have been sort of distant and sort of impersonal. It wouldn't really work for the material. Mm-hmm. So I'm really pleased with how it came out. I was also pleased that I could get John and Leanne's illustrations and art in there, because Leanne's fantastic. She's done some stuff for Retronauts before. I think she did some stuff for the SG-1000 Collector's Edition as well.
She did, yeah. For all of my Collector's Editions books, actually.
Oh, really? Wow. Okay. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, she did like Gradius for the NES 85-86 book. And I can't remember what she did for the 87 book, but she did something there.
Now I've got to buy all of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you do. Everyone has to buy all of them. And we're down to like the last 10% of the collector's editions of NES 87. So you have to hurry on that one.
Crap.
No pressure or anything.
No.
But that is, I'm glad you brought that up, because that is something that I really enjoy with the book publishing process, is just figuring out the materials. Like, what's the hardcover material going to be? Is it going to be like, you know, case bound, which means that the cover art is actually printed as part of the hardcover? Or do I go with like, you know, the cloth wrap that has just the, like a stamped embossed foil title, and then it has a dust sleeve over it? It's fun to really just kind of like say what's going to complement the content and the vibe of this book in you know, in terms of physical materials.
The biggest takeaway for me, and this is, I know this is not a competition, I don't intend to make it that way, but like Maverick Hunter Field Guide, could you hurt someone with it? Yes. Could you kill them? Probably not. boss fight books, very good. Absolutely no chance of killing a human. Sorry. Not going to happen.
This sounds like a challenge.
Jason Bourne could do it.
SG-1000 works, collector's edition, possibly, but could you then hide it? No. So that's my book's main thing. The choice if as a murder weapon, it's the best one of the lot, possibly.
Fair enough.
I'm giving a thumbs up, but you can't see it.
And Stuart, you can actually carve your book, the inside of it, and put a gun in there.
Yes, so that's absolutely true.
And you can also hide a murder weapon in the book.
I was pitching for that for a special edition, but it got knocked back.
All right, so finally, I'd like to move along to the quietest member of this roundtable for today, Kevin Bunch, who I would say of all the books represented here today, yours is the most thoughtful and disciplined of the lot. And that's not a dig at anyone, including my own work, just that you really have taken an academic approach to documenting Atari's history with interviews and tons of research, all of which is extraordinarily well documented, which is something that I am terribly lazy about with my own book. And that's, you know, to my own detriment. So Kevin, tell me about where the Atari Archive project started and if you intended in the beginning that it should ever be a book.
So originally this was me going through the Atari 2600 library, you know, game by game. I wanted to look into the context and the history of each release because information existed to some extent, but it was very scattered. And it took me a few years to even figure out when all of these games came out. That was an exhausting period. But initially, I did not really have any expectation of turning this into a written work. This was sort of a project for me to learn how to do video editing. Which is why a lot of the videos are a bit crap, especially early on. But at some point, I decided I should start putting this stuff down in print because, hey, I'm a professional writer. This is kind of my whole thing. And also, you know, no one wants to cite a video I found online. I remember it really came into clarity for me. I did a video about the you know, the Star Trek games 2600 port a while ago, and I interviewed the guy who made the original Star Trek game, and he thought it was really good, and it pulled in his insights very well. So he added to the Star Trek games Wikipedia page some information from that video, and within like 2 days, one of the editors on Wikipedia removed it because it was a video, and therefore, you know, the citations were too loose and couldn't be counted. And that got my goat. And I said, okay, well, I'm just going to turn this into a book, and he's going to eat that. And as it so happened, a couple months later, I think you reached out, Jeremy, and asked if I was interested in doing a book of Atari Archive, and as luck would have it, I was.
Excellent. Wow, how fortuitous that I exist. What's the process been for putting together first the videos and then converting the video material into books? I mean, your videos are very structured and extremely detail-oriented, but I feel like the book takes that material to another level in terms of just the, you know, the substance there and the documentation.
Right. So my idea for this was that all of these games, you know, they're very old. They, in a lot of cases, predate any sort of online writings about them, or at least online writings that I could easily source, you know, where they came from. So my idea was, okay, I'm going to go back to the sources whenever possible. So, you know, I tracked down the people who wrote these games. Some of them have online presences. A lot of them I had to just look up some names in the white pages and fire off some letters and hope that I had the right person. Which is a shockingly effective approach when you're dealing with a bunch of senior citizens. So the Internet Archive was extremely useful because a lot of these old game periodicals were on there. I also went ahead and got subscriptions to newspaper services so you could look up newspaper archives and find articles and advertisements, that sort of fun stuff. And then you got into the weeds, as I would like to call it, of the materials that are not online, at least not very easily findable online. Some of this stuff I was able to get from other video game history nerds who had gone out to some of the archives near them and taken photographs of materials, and they were willing to share those. Others, I had to go to the archives myself. I visited the Library of Congress. I visited the Strong Museum. The Hagley Museum and Library has a bunch of RCA papers there. Just bouncing all over the place, pulling together these materials. And then I had to figure out how those were all related for these particular games. In some cases, it was pretty straightforward. And in others, I wasn't able to get quite as much together, so I just sort of did the best I could with what I had. And that was for the videos. And when it came to the books, I figured, well, I have all of this information that I didn't have when I started, so I can add that in. That's obvious. Some of this information I can shuffle around. Maybe it doesn't need to be in this particular chapter. Maybe it can be its own chapter. And also, since it's in print, I can bring in a bunch of stuff that would not have flowed very well in a video. So I can delve into more detail on, say, for the Space War article, I could talk about the creation of Space War in more detail than I did originally. So that was a lot of fun. I really appreciated that. And then, of course, I added in a bunch of extra chapters about different competing platforms, just some broader history of what was going on in the video game space at the time. So yes, I was happy to be able to pull all of that stuff together for the book, and of course, to make sure it read well, I initially wasn't sure if you folks were going to do a whole lot of editing for it, so I hired, as a freelancer, the copy editor I used to work with when I worked at newspapers, and she was more than happy to do this. She had no experience whatsoever with video games, and I really appreciated that, because, you know, like Bob was talking about, when you're stewing in this stuff for so long, you kind of take all the jargon and terminology for granted, and she had no clue what any of these things meant. She's, you know, for example, I remember whenever I used the term, you know, ported a game from the arcade, she's like, what the heck does that mean? What is a port? So I had to explain what that was. If there was acronyms, she pointed those out. Just all sorts of little things like that, making sure I was using active voice more than I originally was. So I really appreciated her help on that one.
Yeah, my finding is that the more people you have copy editing a book, the better it's going to end up being. We did do our own, revisions on that, but also, you know, with my books, that's been one of the, I would say the biggest changes between the sort of early self-published editions that I did and the more recent ones, like the book that just came out, last year from me is NES Works 1985-86. That got its start in, I think its first edition was in 2015, just covering the 1985 stuff under the name Good Nintentions. Yeah, and that was self-published, and it was really just me taking the video scripts, removing just some of the video-specific commentary and publishing it. And, you know, I read through everything, but I'm kind of blind to the errors in my own work. It's not so much like I don't see the, you know, structural issues or whatever. Like that, I feel like I'm pretty good at catching, but just typos and, you know, when the word "the" shows up twice consecutively, my brain just cruises right on past that because I know what I'm saying in my head, and whether or not it actually says what's in my head on the page, my brain is just like, yeah, it's all cool. So, you know, being able to have other people put eyes on that is great. So with my books, I pay someone, you know, to do very thorough freelance, copy editing, and it's worth the investment. And then because it's going through press run, it still gets a copy edit pass by our copy editor, Jared Petty. And so that's, you know, two sets of eyes that are not mine. And the result is that, you know, the most recent couple of books that I've put out, SG-1000 Works and NES Works 1987, are just much cleaner works than the previous books that I did where I was doing my own copy editing. And I don't really see people write in to say, hey, I found some problems with your book. Whereas before that, I definitely saw a lot of that. So yeah, it really, that extra touch of polish doesn't just make the writing better, but it also just, you know, it creates a better impression for the reader. Like, oh, they took the time to get this right. That's good. And it's not something that they're necessarily conscious of. People notice mistakes, but they don't notice when you get things right. So that's one of those cases where no news is good news. Like, if you don't get feedback about it, it's probably a good thing.
Yeah, I did appreciate Jared's pass as well, because, you know, he has familiarity with the subject matter. Mm-hmm. So if I had something in there that Meredith didn't notice, because she's not a video game dork, he picked it out. And I know there were a couple of points where he asked me to clarify something in more detail or explain what the heck I was talking about that she didn't notice, and he definitely did.
So what was the process involved, if there was a process, in kind of reconciling the things you discovered through research with the things that you were told by people you interviewed? Or were most of the quotes in your work from interviews, or were they from, you know, third-party sources?
A lot of the quotes were from interviews that I'd done. Some of them were from interviews that other people had published. I think one or two might have been from old internal recordings that had been archived, and you could find them online from people who'd long since passed away. And generally, my feeling is that, you know, memory is pretty good, but memory is not perfect. Mm-hmm. So you can definitely get through what somebody feels about something or felt at the time, or their general impressions, experiences. If you're asking for specific details, their memory's probably could range from I don't remember that to pretty sharp. But if there's a paper trail of some sort, that would generally take precedence for me when I was putting this stuff together. And if I was interviewing multiple people about a specific thing, like when I was talking about the development of the 2600 hardware, you know, that's like five or six people I interviewed separately on that one, and each one had their own perspective and their own recollections. And I just sort of tried to assemble that in a way that made sense. And if two of the stories didn't line up, I made a note of that in there. Like, this person remembered this, this person remembered this. It was probably such and such case, but who can say for sure?
Yeah, that's something that Leonard Herman, the games historian who wrote Phoenix, he doesn't talk to people. He doesn't interview people for his writing. because he feels that memory is too unreliable. People are going to give, you know, distorted impressions of what had happened. People may be driven by agendas or may just have forgotten. So he just works from documents and news reports and, you know, whatever hard concrete information he can get his hands on, which I think is very interesting. And I, you know, I don't agree with that personally. I think it's really important when you can to get people's perspectives on the work that they did, but I can understand why he would feel that way. And, you know, I've mentioned this before, but I've been watching, old Doctor Who Blu-rays, and they have each disc has tons, like hours of supplemental content of interviews and commentary by cast and crew. And, you know, like within the same disc, you'll see different takes on the same episodes from people involved, and they'll say things that directly contradict one another. They'll sometimes, you know, be speaking to memories and say, oh yeah, this happened and we did this. And then you actually, you know, see that contrasted against footage of the actual episode where something different is happening on screen. And you just kind of realize like, oh yeah, people do mush things together in their memories, and they're not, the memories are really much more about impressions and feelings than they are about actual sequences of events. So, you know, I can see the challenge there. But I think the way you did it, which is to kind of say, you know, here's one perspective, here's another, these don't line up, but that's what we were told. Like, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm actually running into this because I have been working on another book, which I actually started on before the Atari one, and it just sort of got sidelined, and that's about the history of RCA and their video games and computers. And I've been talking to a lot of old folks for that, and their memories of events don't necessarily line up with what is written out. I just talked to someone about it, like 2 weeks ago, who had his years shifted by, like, one, which is a pretty big deal given how quickly technology and the business was changing at that time. Mm-hmm. So it's just something I've become used to, you know, prior to what I do now with like science communication. I was a newspaper journalist, and you interviewed a lot of people about a lot of things. And you just had to reconcile these things that don't quite add up.
Yeah. So any final thoughts on Atari Archive before we shift into the final phase of this conversation?
I'm really proud with how it came out. I really enjoyed that we were able to pull together all of these details. I'm really glad that Larry Wagner, the guy who wrote Combat and helped develop the 2600 hardware, he was on board with me publishing the interview we did, because he had not really done any interviews prior to that point. And he was really excited for the opportunity to get his story out there. So that's something that I'm keeping in mind for future volumes, you know, checking in to see if anyone wants to do the same that he did. And I do appreciate that I've gotten a lot of really positive feedback from the folks who, you know, have been featured in this and whose stories I pulled from to put this all together. None of them have complained so far, which is very nice.
Yeah, you know, what I've kind of noticed in helping to sell this book at conventions and things is that the crowd, the audience looking for information about Atari is much smaller than people who are eager to read about Sega or Nintendo, but they really appreciate the fact that, you know, someone's taking the time to do this. And the people who are into Atari just are absolutely in love with this book. So I think that really speaks well to the work that you did and the value of the space you're covering, because even though you're not going to, you know, sell 20, 30,000 copies of this book, sorry, Kevin, it's just not going to happen. You know, it's still a valuable creation, and, it was worth doing for sure. And yeah, I hope that more and more people become aware of it and realize that it is one of the, in my opinion, absolute best books of documenting video game history that's been published to date. Like, it's just really incredibly solid.
It's very impressive.
So good work there.
Thank you.
And then, I don't know, I feel like I should talk a little bit about my books, but I guess I kind of have all the way throughout this, so maybe that's not really necessary. So instead, I'm going to open up the floor to everyone, just as kind of a final round, and ask, what would be your recommendation for people who would like to publish a book? You know, if there's someone out there listening thinking, oh, I could do that too, or I wish I could do that, but I don't know how, now's your opportunity to the panelists here, rich with the wisdom of having published a book. What's your advice, not just on getting published, but just on the creative process? Just, you know, finding inspiration, finding information, all of that. Like, go for it. I would love to hear everyone's take, because I'm sure everyone's take is going to be different and distinct.
I would say, on a very practical level, understand what you're getting into, because if you're a creative person, I think most of us are wired the same way. Like, the initial high of starting a new project is the best part, and then you actually have to do it, and then it's not as rewarding until you're finished. So I feel like, understand the amount of work you're going to have to put into it, in terms of if you have time in your life to do this. Because actually, when I first pitched the book, and you know, was very happy, I realized, like, oh crap, when will I have time to actually write this? And it was a real struggle. So I would say, like, understand the practical terms, like what you're able to do, what you have time to do, and if you feel like you can actually commit to a project like this, especially if you're not doing it for yourself, if you're doing it for a publisher who has deadlines and expectations.
So I will say that one of the things that I really enjoy about creating books is that, yeah, you get that initial high of creation, but there's also the stick and carrot at the end. There is actually something substantial that you are going to be able to hold in your hand, to be able to put on your bookshelf, to be able to give to other people, and, you know, hopefully sell to other people and, you know, have some money to show for it. But to me, I don't know, that's something that makes book publishing different than a lot of other creative forms of publishing. You know, making a video, making a podcast, publishing an article online, that's great. But at the end, you don't have something physical to show for it. And I feel like that is its own kind of high. Like, I made this. This was something I did.
Right.
And I don't know, maybe that's not something that everyone shares, but for me, it's a big part of the motivation, just having a thing that exists because of my effort. I really, really find that deeply satisfying.
Yeah, I totally agree. I feel like the best parts come at the beginning and the end. I don't know if anyone else experienced this, and I'm not too offended by it, but when it would come up that I was writing a book, or I had sold a book, or my book was coming out, and a lot of the initial reaction people had, and I think it came from a good place, is like, oh, you know what? I've been thinking about writing a book. And in my head, having gone through the process, I you know, I was friendly, but in my head, I was like, really? Do you really think you're ready for this? Because it is it is a lot of work, a lot of revisions. You're going to be staring at your own text a lot until all the words have lost meaning. I'm happy that I did it, but understanding what it entails is very important before you begin.
Would you write another book, Bob?
I'll be honest, and the answer is probably no, because I feel like this is it for me, and I did what I wanted to with this, and I honestly have no other inklings or any other desire to put anything else out there. Like Nadia was saying, though, we all have so much work that is unavailable, and I have been thinking of compiling a lot of my old work into something that I could kickstart or publish myself. I have like 16 years worth of comedy articles that are just kind of on a dead website right now, and I'd love to compile mm-hmm. those and improve upon those and put those out in a collection. But I feel that I find the podcasting more rewarding now, but I just wanted to get a book out there to symbolize that I was a writer for 20 years and to get what I feel was my best work into people's hands.
Nadia, what about you? I mean, you've already said that you have other book concepts in mind. So
yes.
What would your recommendation be to those looking to get into this this cold and unforgiving space?
Write. That is the most important thing. You cannot do shit until you have words in your hand. And it's so easy to have an idea in your head and think, oh, I can write this down on paper. Oh, shit, this is actually really hard. It takes a lot of hard work. Even if you're, like, tired and frustrated and don't feel like writing, which is me every single day, you still got to sit down. You got to write. And once you start writing, I find that the process becomes very relaxing, very fun. It's just that starting that's sometimes difficult. You know, damn executive dysfunction, I suppose. But yeah, that is the main thing. And also, if you are a creative, I find some creatives have trouble with editing. Like, be prepared to be edited. You don't have to agree with everything, every single thing your editor says, but if they are changing your words, it is usually for the better for what you are, you know, what format you are writing for. And if you get, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Childish and pissy about your words being changed, which I have seen quite a surprising bit in this, in the field of games writing, you're going to have to put on your big person pants and deal with it, because if the editor doesn't scold you, which they usually do very politely, the internet will. And there's like, you know, most people are really good and they leave really cool comments and they're really glad you wrote this. But once in a while you get someone who says, actually the canon that's in your Mega Man book is totally wrong. The canon that Capcom approved is totally wrong apparently. So, that's just the kind of thing you gotta deal with. But it is a very rewarding feeling, especially in this age where digital print is turning into absolute slush of AI and garbage SEO. You know, it will get better, but for now, the printed word is something to just kind of turn to. It's very comforting. So it's worth it. It is absolutely worth it. But don't waste your time saying, oh, I can do this, or shit-talking people who have done it. Just do it.
Yeah, I mean, even AI, there are those books on Amazon you can buy that are
so bad.
Computer-generated. Of course they are. I think, you know, that's also not anything for us to worry about in the long term. Just the world has to get it out of its system and realize, oh, this is terrible.
This is terrible. This is kindergartner writing.
Just like NFTs.
And then I went to the store and I fought a dragon.
Great, great. Good writing.
That sounds
good
riveting. Plus. Then what happened?
Very right. I don't know. What happened to the book I stole from?
Yeah, editors are not always correct. And I've definitely been edited by people who change the meaning of what I'm trying to say.
Same.
And that's not good.
No.
But, you know, when I edit books, I tend to leave a lot of comments and a lot of marks. But it's not like this is crap, this is unsalvageable. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, I'm kind of showing like, here's how I would rearrange this. Here's how I would rephrase this. Here's how you could write this to take out, you know, half of the passive phrases here.
Yeah.
So it's not all, you know, like, things are mysteriously happening and no one knows why. Like, where is the actor in this?
If I could actually interject just one last thing here.
Sure.
Please unlearn all the bad habits about writing that your high school taught you.
Yes,
just,
make you naughty.
You don't need to double space after period. I don't know why that's still going around, but it is. Stop writing
in
passive.
That's from the days of typewriters.
It really is. But how long? Yeah. I learned on a typewriter actually how to type. And that was just before they got rid of all the typewriters and put computers in. But mm-hmm. So I actually learned a very merciless form of typing where if you made a mistake, you got docked marks and you couldn't erase it. So yeah, just unlearn that. Unlearn writing in the passive. That's really hard. So learn how to do that now. But I'm still trying to break that habit. I can't quit you.
Yes, I agree. To add on to Nadia's thing real quick, I agree. When I taught a writing course in grad school, you know, new students were coming in. In the first week, it was just like, unlearn everything you learned in high school. It was all wrong. No one writes like this.
Yeah.
Nobody expresses themselves like this. You can use I statements. You can have a paragraph with more than five sentences.
You can start with but and.
Yes, exactly.
And also, you can use they and them as first person pronouns. I think fortunately, culture has shifted enough so that, you know, those grammar lessons have been made obsolete anyway. But yeah, like there are just lots of things that I had a great high school English teacher, a couple of them who really like kicked my ass and made me a much better writer by just demolishing my grades on essays until I was no longer sucky.
I had a couple of those. Yeah, but not enough.
But you know, not everyone is that fortunate. I really lucked out. And even then, you know, it's still been a learning process. I'm still, you know, 30 years out from high school, still learning things, still,
me too.
Oh, that's right. I need to do this. Oh, I need to avoid that. Yeah. It's a process. So yes, that's definitely something, worth considering. Find an editor who knows what they're talking about, work with them, listen to them. That's very important.
Mm-hmm.
Stuart, what would your perspective be on this? You're coming from, again, a different place from say, Nadia.
Yeah, I don't, yes. I don't know if I really have any advice for anyone, because, like, I'm trying to decide whether I should be really real about it or if I should try and be pleasant.
No, go ahead and be really real. I'm curious to know.
Yeah, turn your chair around.
Okay, I'm going to do that. I'm going to rap with you kids now.
Which direction is your hat, Stuart?
No, for real. I can't do that because I would sit on myself and it would be extremely painful. But I don't really have advice because, like, I'm still not quite at the point yet where I understand that I have a book because it doesn't feel like real. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I'm looking at, I can look at, like, boxes and I open up these boxes with copies of All Games Are Good that, you know, author copies that have been sent. And I'm just kind of like, yep, there they are. And now to go and do something else. And that's not to say I'm not proud of it or I'm not pleased with it, because I am. And, you know, I've had nothing but nice sort of feedback about the book, which I'm very grateful for. And I'm glad it exists. I think it's a good thing. I think it's good, or I wouldn't have even bothered my ass doing it, you know. But sort of anxiety and maybe sort of a tinge of imposter syndrome just does not go away. And all the time I'm just kind of like, I mean, even now I'm sort of like, well, you guys' books are like real books, you know? Yeah, they're not just like about Jelly Boy on the SNES, you know? But that's something that you're going to have to, it's possible you might have to deal with. I don't really know how you deal with it, but if anyone finds out, please get in touch with me and tell me. And then I too will enjoy the existence of having a book to its fullest potential. I mean, I'm doing another book at the moment, and that also is just a case of kind of like, these are words, I've written these words, and these words may end up in book form, and then that will exist too, and then it will all possibly feel much the same, but I will be getting lots of pleasant comments on that one as well, hopefully. It's very hard to explain what I mean, but be prepared to deal with that, because it's quite weird.
So I was going to go last, but I'm going to jump ahead of Kevin here, just because I feel like what my what I settle on as advice is kind of relevant to what you were saying, Stuart, maybe without you realizing it. But I think, you know, just looking at the work you've done and how your articles became a book, the most important thing is just get out there and do it. Not just like what Nadia said about write, but I mean, just put yourself out there and create things, and don't be afraid to do a bad job of it. I mean, if you look at, you know, my most recent publication, SG-1000 Works, I think it is probably the best thing I've ever created, and I'm genuinely proud of it. I think it is a phenomenal publication. It's beautiful to look at. The text is thoroughly researched and revised, and copy edited, and very informative, and as correct as it could possibly be considering the subject matter. But it's not like that was the first book I ever created. And if you go back and look at, you know, where I started with the self-publishing, you know, the first time I took video scripts and put them into a book form, it was a really kind of lousy layout. The photography was not very smart. The text needed a lot of polish. It wasn't that great. And even before that, if you look at, you know, the self-published zines I was doing 20 odd years ago, those are fraught with problems. And it's just been this constant cycle where I, you know, work on things and try, and sometimes I fail, sometimes I don't fail, but I could do way better. And I just keep pushing, you know, myself to do better the next time. And, I don't know, maybe that speaks to like an obsessiveness that maybe I shouldn't be sharing with everyone and foisting upon everyone else. But yeah, I just feel like to really make something like this happen, to be able to publish, you can't be afraid to fail and to try something and for it not to work out and not to be discouraged, but to say, okay, that could have gone better. How could it have gone better? Let's get that right next time. And so I feel like if you look at the things I've published, each book has been better than the last. And I feel like that's a good curve to follow, But it does mean I feel kind of bad for everyone who was there on the ground floor with me, because you bought a book that was made obsolete and is kind of bad by current standards. And I apologize for that. But I'm glad you stuck with me this long, because, you know, I feel like I finally gotten there. Like it's there's still room for improvement, but the improvement has come over the past decade or so, or two decades, if you want to count that far back. And, I'm fortunate that I've been able to fail in creative ways, and that people have still been entertained by my relative failures, and that there's been the opportunity for improvement. You know, people have been very generous and very supportive, and I'm very fortunate that way. So maybe it's easy for me to say, go out there, put yourself out there and try, because, you know, I kind of came into this with having the advantage of a built-in audience thanks to my time at 1UP and US Gamer and so forth. But still, I feel like that's scalable advice, that, you know, it works for people all along the spectrum, you know, of visibility, popularity, whatever, and people who, you know, sell thousands of times more books than I do, still, you know, that's still good advice for them, just as it is for someone who's going to sell, you know, 20 copies of a self-published book. It's just, don't be afraid to mess up, and don't take that as a sign that your work isn't great, because it could be better. You just have to apply yourself and say, all right, I need to learn from my failures here and focus on what's good. Anyway, that's my homily for today. Kevin, what about you? You wrap this up for us.
So I was going to say, I agree with everything you all have said. So I have to come up with something else, but no, my other advice is that, books are very long and they take a lot of time. So you have to parse that out, but also don't forget that you can take it a chapter at a time. You know,
that's true.
If you want to come back to another chapter and revisit it and flesh it out or trim stuff, that's fine. That's part of editing. You just get one thing down, move along to your next item, work on that, and keep going until you've got a whole book together, and then start cutting it up as you need to.
Well, that's it, folks. We wrote a book, each of us. Some of us more than one book. But the point is, we've been published, and you can too, if that's something you want to do. And if not, that's okay too. Thanks for listening. Please check out our books. I'm going to let everyone kind of walk you through where they can find our publications. But collectively, we are Retronauts, and you can find us here, not publishing books, but publishing podcasts, which are like books that we speak off the cuff rather than put into print, at retronauts.com. On Patreon is Retronauts, patreon.com/retronauts. We are supported by, collectively by your subscriptions, your support. Subscribe to Retronauts for, remind me, it's like $3 a month. Then you get every episode a week in advance at a higher bitrate quality with no advertisements than on the public feed. And for $5 a month, you also get a crap load of bonus stuff. It's the better deal. I highly recommend the $5 level. Check it out, patreon.com/retronauts. Bob, where can we find you and your book?
You can find me, I'm still on Twitter as Bob Servo. I'm lurking on Blue Sky as Bob Servo, so I might be posting there at some point. About my book, it is the Boss Fight Books volume All About Day of the Tentacle. You can find that at the Boss Fight Books website, on Amazon, wherever you find books, and it is also available digitally if you don't want a physical book in your home, if you have too many books, or if you just want a cheaper version, you can buy it for any e-reader, Kindle, Nook, you name it. And I also do podcasts for Talking Simpsons. That's my other gig. It's patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. We cover The Simpsons. And behind the Patreon paywall, we cover King of the Hill and Futurama and Batman, the animated series. In the past, we've covered The Critic and Mission Hill. There's over 6 years worth of podcasts there. Check it out wherever you find podcasts, or go to the Patreon to hear all the exclusive miniseries. That's it for me.
Nadia.
Yeah, you can still find me on Twitter at Nadia Oxford until it all burns. I'm on Blue Sky as well at Nadia Oxford. I'm on co-host at Nadia Oxford as well. I do a little bit of blogging sometimes. Primarily, I am a podcaster on Acts of the Blood God, which is a podcast about RPGs, old and new, Eastern and Western. We've been going on for years. Please listen to us. We have a Patreon at patreon.com/bloodgodpod. That's also where I do Charlene Dropout, which is a Final Fantasy XIV podcast. And, yeah, that's, oh, of course, my books. Duh. You can find the books, pretty much anywhere. Amazon, probably find them in bookstores as well. Book fair, apparently, if you want, the real classic experience, hunt it down there. See if you can find it. Let me know if you find my books at book fairs. I will give you a thumbs up, I suppose. And,
RIF, Rockman is fundamental.
Yep, absolutely. And I suppose I'm just always in the field for or an agent of any kind. Like, you know, I'm trying to get more into books and writing stories, especially fiction. If you hear my voice, please reach out. Thank you.
Oh, wow. I didn't even think about the literary agent aspect of this. I know nothing about that whatsoever. So there's still room for improvement in this podcast. See, I'm just totally nailing it right there.
Always learning.
Yep, always learning. Let's see, Stuart.
Hi, yes. You can find me on Twitter at Stupacabra. You can witness my ever-long ongoing breakdowns there. You can read my book, All Games Are Good, available from Limited Run and from Amazon a bit. I think it might be sold out on Amazon, but it's coming back, hopefully, maybe. Unless it's completely sold out, in which case, thank you.
on Amazon? It should be there, yeah.
It was there and then it wasn't there, and it's probably going to be there again. See, this is the live me complaining about the book being on the Amazon. But
as of this moment, it is available for 2-day delivery on Monday, November 27th. Now you know when we recorded this.
That's weird.
So you're good.
Okay, that's great. That's good to know. Cool. Everyone go on Amazon and buy it right now. I need shoes. Other things, I do a podcast called The Dillcast, where we're reviewing, me and my friends Gobbler Chula, Grizzle Grex, and Holly are reviewing every single Dilbert comic ever.
Oh, God.
And we're also playing a Dilbert-themed Dungeons & Dragons game called Keyboards and Cubicles. We just started another round of that. So, yeah, it's basically like Purgatory, but in podcast form. It's pretty great. You'll love it. We'll have lots of fun on there reviewing Dilbert. And I'm also going to plug Ninsight, which is a new Nintendo publication thingy, which is coming soon, that I'm doing the retro content editing for. Ninsight, good name, very good. It's like Insight, but with Nintendo. If you're not sure if everyone got that, definitely get that listened to. That's not a podcast, god damn it. Read, get it read. Listen to the Dillcast, read Ninsight. I'm blowing this.
That's okay, there's always room for edits. Kevin, how about you?
You can find my book Atari Archive on Limited Run Games and on Amazon. That's volume 1. I do not have a volume 2 as of this recording. Maybe by the time you listen to it I will. And you can find me on...
That's very ambitious, because this is going up in like 2 weeks.
Well, you know, maybe they'll listen to it. Maybe they're well behind.
Okay.
But you can find me on Twitter, ostensibly, under Ubersaurus, and on Blue Sky more regularly under the same.
All right. And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, on the internet as Jeremy Parrish, or on Blue Sky as Jay Parrish. I do log into Twitter once a day to check to see if I have DMs, but I've kind of given up on that one. Of course, you can find me on YouTube creating my rough drafts for my books in video form. Look for Jeremy Parrish. Otherwise, this whole podcast has really been kind of ancillary to my day job, which is working at Press Run for Limited Run Games, publishing books, among other things, for people, with people, and for myself. Anyway, that's about it. You can find all that stuff on the internet. We are available and accessible and ready to fill your life with words. So thank you for your support. Thanks, Bob, Nadia, Stewart, and Kevin, for taking the time to come in and share your insights on the creative process. And hopefully people will check out these books if they haven't already and enjoy them, because, I mean, they should enjoy them. They're all great. So we'll be back again in, I guess, like, I don't know, a few days with a bonus episode, or in a week with a not bonus episode. So look for us then. In the meantime, remember, it's patreon.com/retronauts. And that'll give you something to do when you're not reading a book. Thanks, everyone.